Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Advisor. I am Lisa Urbanski, co-host of the show. I have Ashley Poplar here with us. This is her episode 4 or 5. I think it's 5 on our series. So if you go to our channel, you'll be able to find her podcast. She is someone who wears many, many hats. So Ashley is a psychologist, she's an educator, she's a researcher. And a mother whose life work centers around one very powerful theme, which is making meaning through connection. So, whether she's in the therapy room, the classroom, or her own home, she is so committed to building strong relationships and helping others to do the same. Now, that's all going to make more sense to you guys after our episode is over, because she has a story to tell. She just wrote a book last night, actually. It is now live and you can buy it. But what a story. Before we get started, though, I want to thank our sponsors, Spreaker and iHeartRadio, because without you, this would not be possible. So, Ashley, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I feel a kind of excitement that I don't often get in day-to-day life, having finally published the book that I've been working on for months with lots of stressors along the way. So it feels good.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
What did you do when you finished it and it was done? What is the first thing that you did?
I published, so when I finished writing it, I was like, yes, I'm done. I got it done. And I had like a celebratory glass of wine. And then I was like, oh, but I actually have to publish it and like get it out there. And that's what happened last night. And when I finally saw the green check mark that the like 80th download or upload I tried finally went through, I just like quickly did everything else so I could be done, and then sent like an 11:30 p.m. message to my sister saying I wrote a book. So nothing that exciting.
Well, I think you're downplaying it. I think that's amazing. I love the celebratory glass of wine because that's amazing. But what a feeling. Do you want to tell our audience a little bit more about who you are before we get into the topic for today?
Yeah. So again, my name's Ashley Poklar. I am a child and adolescent psychologist by way of being a special education teacher first. I worked in alternative schools with the quote unquote bad kids, which really were just kids who experienced trauma. And I realized that I really liked working in those spaces. I liked how building a strong relationship with those kids could really change their outlook on themselves, on adults, on life, on school. And I found that I was better at that than I was at teaching math at 10 different levels. So when I had my oldest daughter, I went back to school for my master's in counseling and then went straight into my doctorate. Because I wasn't able to get people to listen to me on behalf of my clients because I didn't have the right letters after my name. And so I went on, I had 4 kids in that space, 3 daughters and a son within 4 years. I had 4 under 4 for a month. It was pretty much survival mode for most of my schooling because I had infants and toddlers and school. I don't remember all of it, which is a trauma response. But what really stood out to me as I continued to work in those spaces, and is that kids need strong communities, not just strong parents, and parents need strong communities because a parent can't always be everything for their child at all times. And that's really a theme that I've seen throughout as I leaned more into this anti-trafficking, child sex exploitation space. And really, my role in the organization Sentinel Foundation is to connect with other organizations and just kind of build bridges where there used to be silos. And that looks different from place to place, but one of the needs that kept on coming up, that was probably a need of mine while I was in school, is the need for really strong and purposeful self-care. And so that's kind of what I leaned into in that book space while still doing all of my other more therapeutic type of work, on the front lines.
Wow, that is so amazing. And holy smokes, you said that 4 kids getting a degree. What an experience that must have been. Crazy.
Yeah,
Good for you.
it's doable. I tell my students, I teach doctoral level classes now. It's doable, but it is not easy. I don't know that it's something I would recommend, but I also am not sure that I would have gone on for that level of schooling if I was already established with my kids. I think the fact that it was a new normal every year, while off-putting and not super stable, kept me from getting too comfortable and living in that comfort.
Beautiful, beautiful. So you were just talking, we were talking a little bit before the show, and you were telling me about the catalyst that got you to write this book. I want you to tell our audience about the catalyst that got you to write this book. So can you talk to everyone about your trip to Africa, what you were doing there, and how the what the inspiration for the book is?
So as part of my work with Sentinel Foundation, I have gone to Uganda a couple of times. Our organization goes about monthly to participate or support a partner organization, ACOA, which is built out of Uganda. They are continuing to expand in Uganda, but they're based out of Masaka. And so I was brought in to provide some additional resources for both local law enforcement and military, and for the social workers in these sex and gender-based violence clinics. The sex and gender-based violence clinic works closely with law enforcement to try to ensure that when victims come to them and share experiences of abuse, that there actually is proper follow-through, that they catch the perpetrators, and that they're able to make lasting court cases where people actually get prosecuted. But part of the problem is your victim tends to be a child, and children with trauma reactions tend to respond differently than you would expect normal children to respond. And so part of my training that I provided both to law enforcement and to the social workers was around how do you connect with traumatized children? And if you remember earlier, that was what I was good at when I taught. I was good at connecting with the kids that people thought were bad, that people had a hard time connecting with. I was good at finding shared space, making them feel safe, not pushing them too hard too soon. And so I was able to build off of that my own personal experience and what the science says, what the research says about how the brain's impacted by trauma, and provide training to them on what is a normal trauma reaction. How do you respond when somebody has a fight mode? How do you respond when someone freezes? And not only could I do that in this lecture type setting, but I also was able to go to their different centers and provide some one-on-one support. So the story that really sticks out to me in that space was a child. He was 4. He had witnessed his dad murder his twin brother. He wasn't talking. He kept on freezing. And the social workers are like, we don't know where his mom is. He doesn't know his mom's name. We can't, like, the judge is going to release dad if we can't find somebody for this kid to go to, because kid's safer with dad than being alone. And so
I love how
I came in
she, to
and
the listeners out there, she did air quotes there.
yes, safer in that there really isn't a children family services in Uganda the way that we have here. So unless you have a place to put a child, they are better off with an abusive parent than with no adult taking care of them, which is a hard reality to sit with. And so I sat in there, I watched the social worker talking to this child. The social worker was translating for me. And the child freeze mode, he had the same statement that he gave over and over again, and nothing more. Eyes staring straight ahead. And so I was able to use some of the tools that I had taught them, drawing and playing, and let's dance right now because you're in trauma mode. Let's get you out of it. And so through doing that, we were able to get the kiddo to. He ended up sitting in my lap, which in the US is probably a no-no, but Ugandan culture is one that all adults kind of come together to care for the child. So he climbs into my lap, we're drawing a picture, and we find out that he has multiple older siblings that nobody knew about, and he knew their names. So they were able to use that information to find somebody willing to take him in, a family member willing to take him in. But we had to get him out of that trauma space. While he's in this trauma space and I'm teaching them skills to get him out, like let's dance, let's do something fun, let's distract. It was also clear that the social worker needed to do those same things because he was in a trauma space too from having heard the hearing this story over and
Wow.
over and over again. And that's what started to come up as I was visiting these centers. We're talking about the kids, and I'm giving them different tips and tricks to bring the kids out of this space of stress and trauma, but realizing that the adults don't have a toolkit to do that either. And they were asking for it. They were saying, how do we go home and hold all of this? How do we go home knowing that the world's like this and come back and be ready to go again? And there was some. They were being a little bit cynical about some of the cases, which is normal in this kind of space. That's a symptom of burnout. And so they were asking for, and they wanted hard copies, like ways to self-care. And I, as I was flying home that from that trip, I thought to myself, I mean, if I'm going to write this for them, I might as well do it right and write it for everybody because we talk about self-care more in the US, but the reality is the way we talk about it is take a day off of work. That's not making any of those tough situations go away. A day off of work is just prolonging the inevitable, and almost makes it worse when you go back the next day because nothing's actually changed. Getting your nails done, getting your hair done, all these time intensive things, going running, like, which all of those are great, but that's not the extent of self-care. And it's not as wraparound, it's not as preventative as it needs to be. It's always a knee-jerk reaction to when you're already fully burnt out. And the research, and this I can speak to, I did a study in my doctoral program. I did a meta-analysis of burnout interventions to see which type were the most effective. None of them. None of them are effective. And the reason is because by the time that somewhere is like, oh, we need a burnout intervention for a helping profession, the reality is everybody's already so far burnt out that there's not a fix. It's already too late. You have to catch it earlier. You have to be preventative and you have to be aware that when it starts to creep in and have ways to manage it.
So you're in Africa, you're working with these caregivers and social workers. And they ask you for self-care tips, and you go home and write a book to provide them so they have these tools. That is unreal. So what's your book called? It's called The Inner Compass, a workbook and planner toward purposeful living. And you said it was an interactive book, and it provides you with a blueprint on different things you can do for self-care. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I kind of looked at it again as how can we prevent, how can we catch it, how can we manage it? And through that lens, again, of burnout, but also just stress. For those who don't know, the main researchers of burnout really break it down into three categories: emotional exhaustion, depersonalization or cynicism, which is like seeing your clients as just another one. Oh, there's that one again. So, kind of taking away the humanity of the people that you're working with, especially if you're in the helping profession, and then reduced personal accomplishment. So, I had that in mind as I was writing this workbook is how can we address each of those specifically. So there is a section that says challenge cynicism and depersonalization. And what are the approaches that help to manage emotional exhaustion? What helps you feel accomplished? But also, how do we prevent it? So just healthy living. I think we forget about that. We forget that just getting enough sleep, drinking water, eating healthily, going outside, those basic things that our bodies interacting with other people face to face, those basic things that our bodies and brains were created to thrive off of, we don't always engage in those in our day-to-day life, and our brain and our bodies have a physiological response to that. And so that's section one is just the basics, like just getting those basics and being aware of them. And so what's kind of neat about how it's written is it's in tidbit sizes, like a page of information for you, half a page of information for a section. So for example, finding joy in every day. half a page of information talking about how finding joy in every day impacts how your brain works, how it releases serotonin, how it challenges negative thoughts, those kinds of things. And then there's two or three activities per section that you can do to build on that particular activity. So there's two or three ways to find joy in every day. And so it could be a whole week spent on one or two pages for you to really get into the feel of it. And what I added to it, that they didn't particularly ask for, but that I thought could be helpful, is the second half is 52 weeks worth of a one-page planner that has ways for you to write your goals, ways to do gratitude, what page are you working on, your reflection of the past week, and then a prompted journal guide for each week as well. So it's a way to keep you accountable to yourself. There is a section at the end about accountability partners. So my hope is that you bring somebody in, because if you tell somebody you have a goal, you're more likely to do it. And it goes into the science for how that works. But it's a way to be accountable. It's a way to kind of say, you know what? I tried finding joy in every day and it was not for me. And the reality is, none of the book is going to be completely for everybody. There's just certain strategies that fit your goals, that fit your values better than others. And that's okay. I don't expect it all to work for you. I wouldn't want it all to work for you, because then I think you'd be lying to me about its effectiveness. So I really went at it from multiple different directions, using multiple different theoretical approaches, so that you could find something in that 40, I think it's 45 pages of activities and information. There's something in there that each person can find that will actually help you feel more balanced, more content. I'm not even going to say happy, but content with what's happening, more like you're on an even keel.
Amazing. So tell us what a common theme was for those social workers in Africa. Like, what was something that you found that was new to them or they weren't doing? Or what is something that social workers fail to do, forget to do, that is really important?
Those little moments. The section that they found the most helpful was the mini moments section. And honestly, in my work, when I remember to do them, they really are helpful. It's remembering to use them. And it's the idea that you don't have to take the next kid in line right away. You can send one out and take a minute to reset, to take a deep breath, to enjoy a sip of coffee, to shed off what you were holding in that session before you start another session. And I see that in my work with parents too. If parents could allow themselves or give themselves permission to take those mini moments to, you know what? I'll be right there. Go over here, let out my feelings, take a moment, and then come back. A lot of the stress that we feel wouldn't be as heightened because we took some time to let some steam out before we went into the next stressful situation.
Right. So what I'm hearing is that they like just over people overwork themselves, or they forget about, I need a minute for myself. Like there's people waiting for me, there's people relying on me, and then they're not taking a second. I think that's pretty common.
And I no judgment here. Like I said, I like every time I'm riding an airplane and they do the whole like put your mask on before you help somebody else. In my mind, I'm thinking, all right, how can I get a mask on all four of my kids before I put my mask on? And I know better. Like I get it. And I still that like initial, especially if you're a helping professional or a parent and your sense of self comes from what you give to others. It feels like an attack on what matters to you to put yourself first. And like I can give a whole speech about how putting yourself first helps you be better prepared for others. But again, in my day-to-day life, I don't always believe it, not in that moment. And so it really is that like, so what I challenge myself with and what I encourage people to challenge with is it an emergency that needs to be managed in this next 30 seconds? Most of the time, no. That 30 seconds, you not being there for that 30 seconds is not going to impact that child or that individual in any way, shape, or form. But taking that 30 seconds for yourself is going to impact you significantly.
Right. Now tell the listeners What are some of the signs that you should look for? Like, what are some, because you were talking earlier about burnout and how that was another reason why you wrote this book, is you want to help people prevent burnout. Tell me the statistic, or tell the audience the statistic that you told me earlier about burnout.
I don't even remember.
Oh, you were talking about the study and what
Oh.
you actually found. Yes,
Oh
that is
yeah.
so interesting.
Yeah, so the fact that burnout interventions are 0% effective, because by the time that we use a burnout intervention, it's already too late. By the time that your workplace realizes that you're burnt out and are like, "Oh, we should do something for you," it's too late. Once you have all three of those, once you have the emotional exhaustion, the depersonalization or cynicism, and the reduced sense of personal accomplishment, you're done. Most people, the only fix for that is to leave wherever they're working and start new or start over. And that's not an option for everybody. So self-awareness is key. There's a section in the book on that as well. Being able to catch yourself at the start. And it almost always starts with the emotional exhaustion. So if you could catch yourself when you start to feel tired, when you're coming home and feeling just ready to go to bed, or you're waking up in the morning and really not feeling rested, not wanting to go into work. You don't hate your job, you just aren't feeling fulfilled. That's when you need to start doing the intervention. So if you were already living healthy, already doing those basics, and you're still feeling that way, that's when you need to step up and do some of the extra strategies, some of the additional things beyond having a healthy sleep pattern, eating healthy, going outside. That's when you need to start implementing changes or adding in different activities in your day-to-day, and maybe being aware of when you start to feel those. So are there certain activities at work or certain interactions or certain people that take more out of you? And start to plan those activities before those. Like, for example, as a therapist, there are clients that I don't particularly enjoy having. It's not a them thing. It's more a me thing, but we don't always jive with everybody. And so that includes clients. And so there are some clients that I know I need to make sure I take that minute. It might not matter for some of the clients that I enjoy being around, but before client X comes in, I need to take that minute so that they don't drain me, and so that I'm more effective in my work with them.
Yeah, that's so important. So, Ashley, why do you think we, by the collective we as humans, wait till it's too late? Like, why is that a common theme?
I think we don't see it at first, or we think that it's something else, somebody else's fault. If this were just different, then things would be better. We're collectively waiting for something to magically fix, or something to change, and we don't have control over that. The only thing we have control over is ourselves. And so waiting for somebody else to fix it, even if you've been very clear about what you need fixed, that's not going to reliably fix it. I also think that we get stuck in just our day to day. We're so busy with just life in general, that it happens without us really even noticing. Like, yeah, we're a little tired, but we think it's because, the kids were busy and we worked late that night, and there's this and there's that, and life's just going 100 miles an hour, that oftentimes we don't even realize that we're feeling anything. Like, we're not even taking stock of what we think or feel until things slow down enough for us to, and then it hits us, the inertia of what we've been carrying on our back hits us.
Yeah. Wow. Ashley, the audience is dying to know what your self-care routine is with the four kids, with your crazy biz career and business and all the things you're doing. What is your self-care routine?
Not as good as it should be, but I
I love your
do.
honesty. Thanks for being
I need to
honest.
use my book too. But my husband and I, we try to do coffee in the morning. It's a good
Oh.
way to kind of connect and just sit and talk and be. I do homeschool my kids. I find that for me, that has alleviated a lot of the stress, because I was having a really hard time finding that that balance that doesn't exist between home and work. And so instead of trying to find a balance, I pulled them, we homeschool, and now I just integrate them into my life. They're a part of my day-to-day. And I find that that feeds me and my soul a lot better. It seems to feed theirs better too. And so for me, there's a section in the book about living your values. That is the one that resonates the most with me personally. That's the self-care strategy that when I started using it, it really redefined how I felt about myself, how I felt about my work, how I felt about my roles, both in work and at home. And for me, that's when I make decisions, bigger decisions, small decisions every day, I just ask myself, is this in line with my values? And I check my values regularly because they change. There's an activity where you can go through and you find your top three values. And mine almost always include some level of meaningful work, some level of connectivity. So I throw family and friends into that. And then some level of spontaneity or adventure. And so I find that as long as I'm living those values, as long as my work feels like it's purposeful, as long as it feels like I'm making a difference, and as long as I'm finding time to connect purposefully with my children, with my colleagues, with other people in the world, that it tends to my ten my life tends to run smoother, and I tend to feel less burnt out than when I get stuck in the weeds and I'm head down, not interacting, doing busy work that needs done, but not taking the time to make sure that there's some of that meaningful piece built into it. That's when I really start to feel that emotional exhaustion and reduced sense of personal accomplishment.
Was that the first sign for you, for yourself? Because you work with, I mean, sex exploitation, child trafficking, and those are some heavy topics. So what are some of the things you do to protect yourself, or what are some of the signs that you see, and then how do you intervene in your own life?
Yeah. So for me, one of the hardest parts of my work is when I'm doing the direct care stuff. So sitting
What does
with
that
that
mean?
4-year-old,
Okay.
like face to face with the client. So sitting with that 4-year-old, I do a lot of assessment for individuals who have faced trauma to really help them and their caregivers understand how the trauma plays out. And hearing those stories firsthand from the child who experienced it, that's really heavy for me. Heavy enough in that space that I've taken to bringing one of my students with me for those testing cases so that I have a person to talk with about it, so that I have a person to bounce ideas off. So I'm not holding that child's whole story because to myself, that I'm able to share the burden with somebody, and we're able to talk through it and to process it, because it's not the child's job to make me feel better about the trauma that they faced. And so I have to take that home and do something with it. But it's confidential. I can't take it home and talk to my husband about it or talk to a friend about it. So having a colleague that I can process it with has made a huge difference. And finding the little wins, I think a lot of times in just in human nature, we want to only identify those like big mountaintop wins. But the reality is, if I try to climb the whole mountain of child sexual exploitation, I'm never going to make it to the top, and I'm going to quit. I'm going to stop because it's insurmountable. But if I can climb that one little ledge and make a difference for this person or for this group of people, if I can climb this other ledge and provide training, and that training can trickle out to multiple other kids that each of those individuals is working with, then I can find that meaningfulness that I was looking for. So it's having to kind of check myself and remind myself of the wins that I've had along the way, because it's really hard. It's really easy to lose sight of them and to just be looking at that next mountaintop and forget that I've climbed all these other ones behind me. I actually made a joke, and I'm probably actually going to do it, that I need to just draw a mountain range and label all of the wins that I've had so that I have a visual representation when I'm feeling like I'm not doing anything useful.
We're so hard on ourselves, right? Like all of the things that you've done in your life, with your career, the kids, the school, the work that you do, it's all so amazing. It's we forget about those little things. You know, even getting up and brushing my teeth, sometimes I'm like, good job, Urbanski, good job. You did it, right? You just have to make life fun and do what we can. So I have a couple more questions and then we'll wrap up for today. But where did your inspiration come from to do this type of work?
So at first I had a hard time knowing where it came from. But then I was sharing a story a couple of months ago, and it just came to me. There was a young lady that I worked with in the jail. She was in the juvenile detention center. I was in my last year of my master's. She was in for murder. She murdered the man that was abusing her. And she was struggling with big questions, with will God forgive her? What does her life look like? What is she? If she's a murderer, can she be a good person too? Just
Oh, wow.
really, and she's 15, like a 15-year-old, who experienced things that a 15-year-old should never have to experience. And now it's changed her sense of self forever. And I was advocating for her, and that's what led to me going on for my doctorate. Because I couldn't, they wouldn't listen to me. I didn't have the right letters after my name. But she really was the one that opened my eyes to how those kinds of traumas play out. And as I opened my eyes to it, I started seeing these other girls in the detention center coming through who were, they were in and then they were out, and then they were in and then they were out. And they kept on getting picked up for domestic violence, finger quotes again. But in reality, they were trying to protect themselves or protect their mom from abusers or from people who were using them. And they weren't being heard because they were the angry ones when they were getting picked up. So the cops take whoever's still worked up. So these men were basically playing them, and getting them to be the ones in trouble. And so as I started to see that, that's when I started to realize a lot of the girls that were being brought in, and in most states this isn't the case anymore, but at the time it was popular or common that teenagers were getting picked up for prostitution. But the reality is a 15-year-old can't be a prostitute because they're a minor, and so they're being raped. But they were the ones coming and staying in jail. And they wanted to stay in jail. They didn't want to go back to where they had been picked up from. And so that really opened my eyes to it. So then when a friend of mine who was in that anti-trafficking space was talking about all these rescues that they did overseas, I was like, cool, where'd all the kids go? And he goes, what? I was like, where are all the kids? How are they doing? And he goes, I don't know. And so he started looking and realized that he didn't know where the kids went. They put them in a overseas orphanage and then they disappeared. And the numbers support that. About 80 to 90% of kids who are in a trafficking or exploitative situation end up back in one within 3 years. And so
Jeez.
that's how I got involved, was I wanted to change that number. I wanted to ensure that, first of all, if we can prevent it, let's prevent it. But if for some reason we weren't able to prevent it through teaching parents and students and teens what to look for, then at least we can meet them where they are and provide them with appropriate supports, kind of bridging the gaps between all the silos of support that are out there, and ensure that the number drops, because 80 to 90 is that's a ridiculous amount of kids who are already in a vulnerable space just being used again.
Gosh, I worked in probation for a little while myself, and I'll never forget this one case. This woman who she was just completely distraught, completely shut down. She was sitting in my office, and she was getting raped by four men. She ended up killing one of them, and she was being sent to jail. Nothing was being done for her. And I remember it completely just destroying me and like my faith in like the system. And I felt helpless. It's like, I don't know what to do for you. I was so young. I was in my early 20s and we were working on a pre-sentence report and I was just completely torn apart. And that happens all the time. How devastating is that?
Yeah, it's hard. The people that haven't worked in these systems, they say, "Oh, well, the system's there. You remove them from a bad place and things are better." But when you've worked in these systems, you know that even if there are good people working in the systems, that's not the truth. The systems don't protect or support in the ways that they need to. Not especially not these really complex cases.
Yeah. Oh, and it was just crazy. Really eye-opening in a lot of ways. So I really appreciate the work you're doing and how and understand how incredibly important it is. Yeah. And our audience is going to listen to this and be so inspired. So tell us where your book is. How do we get it? Everyone's going to be excited. You just released it. You're probably exhausted, but you look amazing.
Thank you. So I did the whole self-publishing route because that seemed like the easy thing to do. We can talk about that some other time. Not necessarily the easy way
Further
to do
episode,
things.
next
Yeah.
episode.
But so I used books.by. So it's books.by
Okay.
/ a dash Poklar dash ponders, or you can find me on LinkedIn. And I'm posting it there, or you can ask me. But books.by/a-poklar-ponders, which is my website, apoklarponders.org. It's not up on my website yet, but it will be in the next like week or so.
Amazing. And we're going to have all that for our audience in the show notes as well. So they will have easy access to finding you. So, Ashley, before we go for today, is there any last few things you want to leave our audience with?
Yeah, I think based on what we've discussed today, I think the biggest thing is self-care is a personal thing. Yours is going to look different than your family members, than your neighbors, than your colleagues, and that's okay. It's just a matter of finding what works for you, and that starting with that self-awareness is really step number one, is really knowing yourself. And what the warning signs or yellow flags are that you're starting to kind of lean into that space of emotional exhaustion or reduced personal accomplishment or just increased stress. And that looks different for different people. And there's no right way to self-care. There's no perfect way to self-care. And some days you'll do it better than other days. And that is also completely normal. So it's not something that you ever succeed at and master. It's something that is just an ongoing process and it changes as your life experiences and situations change.
So, sounds like we need to give ourselves a break.
If you can, yeah.
Amazing. Well, Ashley, it's been so amazing talking to you today. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. I really enjoy it.
Amazing. And you're going to be back. Do we have an episode outline for the next one? Or are we going to keep the audience wondering?
Keep the audience wondering. Every time I try to set one, I get sidetracked. So.
Well, it's okay. It's intuitive. I feel like today was really powerful and you got a really great message out there. So whatever it is, it'll be great. So stay tuned. Again, thank you for being here. And to the audience, thank you so much for being here and being here with us and listening to Ashley tell her story, talk about her amazing book. And self-care is so important. So again, we're going to have that link in our show notes for you so you can have easy access to that. And so until next time, I'm Lisa Urbanski with The Advisor. This is Ashley Poplar and signing off for now.